Welcome to C2Y Podcast, discussions on child and youth care. My name is Wolfgang Vashaw. This podcast is an extension of Connect to Youth. Connect to Youth, or C2Y, is a program that hires young people who have personal experience in the youth social services system. These young people train those of us who work with young people. Our vision is that every professional who works with young people is trained by youth who have been in the system. C2Y has recently started a new project called Acting Out. Acting Out will be training professionals on working with lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer youth. Why train professionals to work with this population? LGBTQ youth are overrepresented in the homeless youth population. Approximately 25 to 40% of homeless youth in Canada identify as LGBTQ. That compares to 5 to 10% of the general population. Lesbian, gay, and bisexual youth who disclose their sexual orientation are often forced out of their homes, end up on the streets, or in the child welfare system. Two Toronto-based reports, where C2Y is located, identified that child welfare agencies were not welcoming nor competent to provide care for LGB youth. Research has shown that LGBTQ youth are more likely to be at risk for substance use, behaviors that may lead to HIV or other sexually transmitted infections, attempt suicide, and be victims of violence. Many child welfare and other agencies serving youth are working very hard to change these outcomes. C2Y is part of this process. In other parts of the world, the situation for LGBTQ people is much, much worse. Two horrific examples are Uganda and Russia. Today, I'm speaking with Herschel Russell. Mr. Herschel Russell is a trans male psychotherapist, educator, and activist who specializes in lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender counseling. More recently, Herschel has begun working with parents of gender-independent, gender-nonconforming children. Welcome, Herschel.
Glad to be here.
To start with, I would like to help our listeners have a little bit of language regarding sexual orientation and gender identity before we move into how to support young people. In the introduction, I was using the term LGBTQ. This is a shortened version of LGBTTIQQ2SA. What does all that stand for, Herschel?
It can get awfully confusing for outsiders. And I get a little sick of the alphabet soup myself. But it's really an attempt to both be fully inclusive and to understand that each of those letters represents something a little different, sometimes something significantly different. So would you like me particularly to talk about the T-T-I, that bit?
Certainly. I think most of us understand that L stands for lesbian, G stands for gay, and B stands for bisexual. So certainly the TTI and would be helpful.
Here it comes. There should really be three Ts. First of all, let's start with the T that's for Two-Spirit people. Two-Spirit people, it's a name developed by a group of elders at a big international powwow in the early 1990s. And it's a name to describe the many, many different ways our First Nations and American Indians have gender systems that are different from current white middle-class North American gender systems. So someone who identifies as Two-Spirit might enjoy same-sex sexuality and or might have a different gender identity than straightforwardly male or straightforwardly female. So that's Two-Spirit.
Two-Spirit does not necessarily mean gay or lesbian or bisexual or transgender. It could be anything within that umbrella.
Exactly. And it's one of the things we really need to move away from is this idea that there's some ahistorical, international, true of all cultures way of being non-normative in terms of gender and sexuality. There are so many beautiful, exquisite histories and ways of thinking about ourselves from across the world and from across history. It's such a shame to reduce it to the one dominant mode.
Do you have a sense of how that shift happened in mainstream North American culture, how it has become so limited?
Well, it's a history, I'm afraid, of brutality. It's part of the history of colonialism, that we certainly know that this is true in so many parts of the world, but we certainly know that first white influx into North America were particularly brutal with people whose gender they saw as confusing or different. There's a very famous picture from the 1500s of a Portuguese general using dogs to murder First Nations people whose gender he finds troubling. So that, I'm afraid, is part of the history, is the deliberate elimination, physical elimination of people who didn't fit the expectations of the white colonialists.
The term two-spirit is relatively new, but the concept is multi-generational.
Well, ancient, except, two-spirit, again, is this generalization. There isn't a First Nations culture. There are hundreds and hundreds of First Nations cultures that are as different from each other as Italians are different from Germans, as Koreans are different from Japanese, as Somalis are different from Egyptians. We're talking about a huge range of cultures, and one of the critiques of the term two-spirit is it tries to jam all of those together as if they were one thing, and they're not.
So that's two-spirit. There's a couple other T's there.
So there's transsexual and there's transgender. And there's been a huge debate about what those words should mean from within the trans community. And it seems to have settled down for the moment. I'm sure it'll come up again in other contexts. But right here, at least in Toronto, probably not in Montreal, but definitely in Toronto, Vancouver, Halifax, transgender is a broad umbrella term to embrace everyone whose gender doesn't fit neatly into the expected box of male or female. So transgender is just a very broad, it kind of rhymes with umbrella, so transgender umbrella, a broad term to refer to a very large, very diverse group of people. Where transsexual is a smaller group within that, of people who have or who need to access some kind of medical support to make the outside fit the inside, to have their bodies match more closely who they are on the inside.
So might that be what people think of as surgeries, so double mastectomies or building a penis, things like that would be considered a transsexual?
I wasn't sure where to begin there. And double mastectomy is not really a term to use about trans men. Actually a different surgery. It's actually a different surgery. So it's chest reconstruction surgery. And of course, there's this complex piece that a lot of people are familiar with terms like pre-transition and post-transition. It's more complicated than that. A significant group of trans people who do live in the gender opposite to the gender they were assigned at birth have no interest in surgery, or like myself, can't access surgery for health reasons. So that assumption that all trans people have surgery is an important one to just let go of. You wouldn't believe, Wolfgang, how many total strangers feel entitled to walk up to any trans person, including me, and say, so how far along are you in your journey? Have you had your surgeries? Mm. One of the things I do at trainings is I say, okay, so what's wrong with this question?
Great.
And people do quite well at really accessing the many, many things that are wrong with this question. It's a question about my genitals. It's none of your business.
Yes.
it's often an assumption that there's just one surgery. And of course, there's a huge range of surgeries. And the task of choosing what is the best of the alternatives for each individual is a very complex task. And again, something that's private.
So when working with trans people, and I tend to default to the term trans because it's easy to trip up. So when working with trans people, and not just tripping up, but insult or make mistakes or offend, and the last thing service providers want to do are any of those things. So how do we work with language around transgender, transsexual for people who are trying to work within or support the trans community?
It's a lovely question. The word trans has been developed as an intent of having something inclusive for this very, very diverse community. And these days it's often spelled with an asterisk at the end. So trans with an asterisk after it. But the important thing, as you say, is to ask, you know, this particular person who I'm working with to say something, for example, like I'm very familiar with working with the trans community, but how do you like to identify? Are you identified as transgender, as transsexual, as trans, or as something else?
Mm-hmm. I have been working with a group of young people as part of the Connect to Youth program, and there's a young person in the group who we go around the room and we say, what is your preferred gender pronoun? How do you like to be identified? And this young person said that they like to be identified as they.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult for me because I kept making mistakes and I kept, you know, tripping up and saying the wrong thing and using the wrong pronoun, and other people in the group would use the wrong pronoun, and we were all trying to bring awareness to each other to it. So is there a way, you know, I'm looking for a secret recipe here, Herschel. Is there a way to stop making those sorts of mistakes with gender pronouns?
Okay, I'm going to disappoint you. Oh. But isn't it wonderful? Like, here's the piece I want to say. There's that wonderful introduction of the pronoun they, and it is a real challenge to learn to use it when you're using it in the singular version. It's a real challenge. It's hard. But there's also the challenge of, you know, someone is sitting in front of me who is 6'2", with very broad shoulders and a beard, and has, with tremendous difficulty, told me, actually, I'm a woman. Mm-hmm. So I'm sitting there as a care provider, and my eyes are saying, man. And I know I need to, every time I'm going to come across to a pronoun, I need to get it right. Because if I don't get it right, I am going to humiliate this person, which is the last thing in the world I want to do. And let's be very clear, when somebody gets the pronoun wrong about me, it's humiliating. It's not just rude, it's rude, but it's also humiliating. So that's how important it is. But here's the good news, that struggle, that effort to get the pronoun right, it messes with your brain in this perfectly wonderful, liberatory way, so that you come to a place where every human being you meet walking down the street or in some social context, you pause before the pronoun because you don't know. You pause, and there's something about that that's respectful. There's something about that that's expansive. It is a very lovely way to have your brain messed with.
Mm-hmm. As distressing as it has been, it has been lovely in many ways, and really forced me to think and challenge myself and to take a pause. And I find when I make the mistake, it's when I'm not present and I'm not thinking and I'm not with the person who's in front of me.
Exactly. Well said. Well said. In terms of using the word they, there's a wonderful short video online, not that hard to find, by Alicia Lim. L-I-M, on how using they in this particular form is actually entirely grammatical, and there's a usage approval of it going way back. And it's also quite a funny little video.
That'd be great, because as a teacher, it also is a bit of a struggle for me.
Yes.
My grammarian gets all a flutter.
And here's another really important piece. When we make mistakes, sometimes somebody will make a mistake about my gender, not so much anymore, but it used to happen a lot. And they'll go, oh, I'm so sorry, and go on for 5 minutes about how sorry they are. And what's happening there is they've shifted their attention away from the fact that they humiliated me and into their own upset.
Uh-huh.
So it's a really important piece. Yes, of course, apologize, but be careful. Don't make it about you. Don't make it about how bad you feel. Apologize and move on and get the attention back on the person that you're working with. Does that make sense?
It makes complete sense, and wise words. Thank you.
We didn't talk about intersex, if I can just...
Oh, yes, please, please, please.
So people can often get confused here. We have this fantasy, this myth, that people come in only two kinds of bodies. They come in straightforwardly female bodies, and they come in straightforwardly male bodies, and it's very different. In fact, we can call them opposite sexes. They're so different, we can call them opposite sexes. This is a myth. In fact, human beings at a biological level, at an anatomical level, come in a huge range, in a whole spectrum. And most of us are kind of on one side or kind of on the other side, but there's a whole group of us who are in the middle. There are at least 200 diagnoses that will result in a body that may be perfectly healthy, but does not fit neatly into a category, male or female. A wonderful book by Karkazis, called Fixing Sex. It's very accessible, and she did a lovely job interviewing three groups of people. People who are intersex adults, people who are parents of intersex children, and clinicians and surgeons who work with intersex people. And in there are a whole series of stories, both about the extraordinary discrimination against intersex people throughout their lives, but also about stories like this. Well, as far as I knew, I was a perfectly normal man, and then I had to have a very invasive pelvic surgery because of a severe health problem, and they discovered that actually I have bits and pieces of the plumbing of a woman and bits and ovarian tissue as well as testicular tissue. So someone who had no clue from the outside or from their lived life that they were intersex was in fact intersex. We also have these extraordinary pieces where a proportion of infants are born with ambiguous genitals. We don't even have accurate statistics on how many of them there are, which just kind of speaks to how powerful the myth is within the medical system as well as everywhere else, how powerful this myth that there are really only two kinds of human beings.
And what happens to these young children when they're born with ambiguous genitalia?
It remains true, Wolfgang, in 2013, it remains true that not long after that child is born, a group of five or six people in white coats are going to walk into the room of those brand new parents, and we're all pretty out of it when you've just had a baby. It's the most intense experience, perhaps, of any. And they will say, there's a very big problem, and we have to deal with it right away. Your child has ambiguous genitalia, and we're going to need to make a decision quickly about which gender they really are and have some surgery. This is still happening. Mm-hmm. And this is still happening despite the fact that intersex adults on whom those surgeries were performed when they were infants, intersex adults are telling us those surgeries were terrible. Those surgeries left me with lifelong urinary tract infections. Those surgeries left me with no sexual sensation. Those surgeries meant I had to keep going back. So I spent every summer throughout the years of elementary school, I spent every summer having another correction to that surgery on my genitals. Can you imagine the impact on those people's lives? But those surgeries are still being done.
I mean, it seems like an obvious question what the alternative to this is. And the alternative, of course, is that we don't perform, or not we, but we as a culture don't perform those surgeries. Why are those surgeries still being performed?
Because of that myth. We have to abide by that myth. And when you read these very poignant stories of why parents decided to go ahead with the surgeries, I mean, number one, if a group of experts descend on you when you're in that vulnerable place, I think it's an extraordinarily difficult time to respond in any way to something that is so unexpected, right? Mm-hmm. But parents would also say things like, well, what would we do with the babysitter? Or, I think they might be shy when they go to the bathroom in school. Those kinds of things, which, you know, when you weigh them up against the actual negative impact on this human being, kind of don't measure up.
Right. Yes.
And, you know, probably it makes sense to decide this kid's this gender or that gender and raise them that way and be paying attention when they're getting a little older to whether that is actually a good fit. And if it's not a good fit, well, let's move over.
So the suggestion might be, without any surgery, make an assumption or a choice, if you will, as a parent about which gender you're going to raise your child in and then see how that plays out.
And wouldn't it be lovely if we all did that?
Indeed. Well said. Well said.
There's this lovely joke by a wonderful trans writer, Kate... having a middle-aged moment.
Bornstein?
Thank you. Kate Bornstein. And the joke goes... some parents are walking along with a new baby and someone comes along and says, what a lovely baby. Is it a boy or a girl? And the parents say, we don't know. It hasn't told us yet.
Nice.
Lovely.
This leads very, very well into the idea of gender independent and gender non-conforming. And particularly in childhood, there's a wonderful interview with you and on TV Ontario, which I'll link to on the website. You can find it on YouTube, discussing gender independence, gender non-conformity with children. What do these terms mean? How do they fit within this larger trans framework?
Lovely question. Some people call them transgender children, but I think we need to be a little wary about using that, because the evidence that we have, the research that we have now, and many of us are very suspicious of it, but the evidence that we have to date is that a large majority of the children who are gender different as children, somewhere in later childhood or at adolescence, revert to the gender they were assigned at birth. So calling them something like gender independent or gender creative or gender non-conforming just kind of leaves open that possibility in a way that actually I think is important. Now, I've forgotten your question. What was your question?
Well, how does it fit in? I think you answered that. You're now working with parents,
yes,
of children who are gender independent, gender non-conforming. As a parent, how could one support their young child who is gender nonconforming?
A lovely, lovely question. And the fascinating thing that is happening right now is that the numbers of families who are saying, my kid feels terrible if I dress them in female clothes and really happy if I dress them in male clothes and call them he. Now, why exactly wouldn't I do what makes my child relaxed and happy? So there's this very large group of parents who are just going ahead and doing it. And sometimes with resistance from their families, from their doctors, from mental health professionals, but it's just making sense and they're doing it. And may I suggest you also link to a really charming film online called In the Life, Becoming Me.
Mm-hmm, I will.
Which just has stories of 8 very different families with children from 5 through 18 and with very different experiences, each of them, who've just gone ahead with that decision in their own kinds of ways. I've watched it 20 times. It still makes me cry every time. And what a lot of those families are saying is, I don't think my kid needs anything. My kid's fine. Down the road, my kid may need medical intervention, and I want to be ready for that. I am worried that my child may face teasing, and I want to figure out what to do to head that off and to increase my child's resilience to it. Those are the kinds of discussions parents want to have. But one of the other things which I really want to emphasize for anyone who's working with children is that one of the things we see a lot with these kids is the kids who are not... There's a whole group of kids who just know there's something wrong, and it's enraging or it's depressing, or it makes it, I just can't eat because there's just something wrong with my body. It can produce a whole bunch of very worrying impacts on the child. And one of the things we're finding is that a group of those children, who knows how large a group, but a group of those children, the issue is actually gender. And if we can begin to ask those questions in age-appropriate ways, sometimes it will emerge that that's the situation. And once the gender piece gets taken care of, a lot of the acting out behaviors or the depressed behaviors just kind of dissolve. Obviously, it's not true of all acting out children, but it is true of a group of them, and we don't know how large that group is. So that one of the tasks that folks in the field are really hoping for is that it becomes part of routine questioning when we begin to encounter any child who's really distressed in some way. Some of the questions we ask are about gender.
And would that extend to questions about sexuality beyond gender? Because of course a trans person can be gay, lesbian, bisexual, heterosexual. I mean, you know, there's the sexual orientation is just as broad within the trans community than it is within any other community. Does that conversation extend beyond just gender to issues of sexual orientation with parents and children as they move through childhood and into pubescence?
Probably not with three-year-olds.
Okay.
I don't think we expect three-year-olds to have any sense of what their sexual orientation might be. But as kids get older, there's quite a lovely piece of research from the UK by Kennedy and Helen around how high a proportion of trans people knew they were trans when they were 7 or 8. And I bet you there are those, I'm not aware of them, but I bet you there are those kinds of studies of lesbian, gay, and bi people. Some people know very young and can feel so isolated and so afraid and so ashamed. I hope that's a little less true now than it was when I was growing up. But it is one of the reasons why it's such a big deal for us to have schools where it's safe for teachers to be out with who they are, so that kids can have these ordinary role models of ordinary people, ordinary adults leading perfectly fine lives, thank you very much, so that if and when they're beginning to become aware of that as part of who they are, they don't have to be frightened about it. I'm remembering quite recently, I was working with parents of a gender-independent five-year-old, and I'm not trained to work with kids, so I'm very careful to say, you know, I'm not a therapist who's trained to work with children, but I can definitely work with you as parents. And then I saw the car with the dad drop off the mom, and the little kid was looking out of the back window with such longing just to get a glimpse of this adult. And I thought, okay, Herschel, you're messing up here. This is ridiculous. So the next time I said, sure, bring your child in. And I had some, you know, some markers and some paper, and the child drew and made some comments, but was so hungry just to see an ordinary adult whose life is going fine, thank you very much, who was the kind of adult this person was going to grow up to be. So I think that piece of visible lesbian, gay, bi, trans adults is just so important for the welfare of all children.
Indeed. How do we support young people growing up, exploring issues of gender, gender identity, sexuality? You know, there is a support structure there. There's a community there for older teens, early adults. You've identified previously that there isn't necessarily one there for younger children and people entering puberty. Yeah. How can we support that as professionals and as parents?
Lovely question. There are a few models that seem to be emerging. And I know Jake Pine's a local researcher, and I know he's doing a study comparing the various models, and I'm really looking forward to that. But roughly what I think we're finding is that what families want and what seems to be useful to kids is they want other families like mine. They want to be able to get together with other families like mine, and they want, both the parents and the kids, want to be around the kind of person they're going to grow up to be. So the kind of structure that seems to be emerging is the second Wednesday of the month, there's an event which includes supper, where the parents can sit together in a room with some kind of leadership and talk about what it's like raising this particular child. And the gender-independent children and their siblings, this is also an issue for their siblings, can have, you know, some really fun art activities or play activities that, in which the kind of issues around gender can be raised, and play. There can just be this kind of ordinary play. I'm not the only kid in the world who's like this. There are other kids like me. And then an event, something also happening for the kind of 10 to 15-year-olds who are going to want, you know, whatever, to create some little play or some music or some fun pre-adolescent kind of thing. So, and it all happens on the same evening, and it's easy to get to, and it happens regularly. So that's one part of the services that people seem to find really useful and fun. And then the other thing is, we hear from parents is, okay, that was great at the beginning when I was so scared and I just didn't know what to do. And it was great when my kid didn't know anybody like themselves. But we don't really want to do that every month. We just want the occasional place where we can meet other families like ours. So what we'd like is big, fun, celebratory activities that we can just come along to and have fun at and just hang out with other families like us. And what we have in Toronto, and I believe in Peel also, is these lovely events that happen 4 or 5 times a year. There's a big picnic coming up where lesbian, gay, bi, trans parents and their children and gender independent kids and their families can all come together and go and have a picnic on the island and build sandcastles and, you know, play in the water and do just ordinary fun family kinds of things. So I think those are the two pieces we really need. And then those places should also be places that can refer where a family or a kid is having some more trouble, where people can access referrals for actual mental health services if that's something they need.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Building community, supporting each other, loving each other, playing together, being present with each other. So there are...
Can I add one more there?
Yes, please.
At the District School Board, there's also quite a lovely group. It's still small, but it's growing, called the Gender Independent Kids Group. Gender Independent Kids Group. And it's sort of like that. It's sort of like what I was just describing. Not with the big celebratory events. Those happen at the 519. But in terms of a regular evening that families can go to.
Nice.
Maybe you'd like to put that link on the website too.
All right. It's going to be a linked full website. So I encourage everyone to go to the website. We're going to move towards wrapping this conversation up. We know a lot of young people who are identify as lesbian, gay, bisexual, or trans have tremendous conflicts and challenges within their families of origin. And many of them are kicked out, are abused, are isolated, and many of them end up homeless, street involved, or child welfare system. Is there anything for professionals who are working with this population or working with the general population and have young people who identify or don't even necessarily identify as LGBTQ? Anything that these professionals can do to support these young people?
Well, it is one of the pieces. We really know how much family support matters. We've got all kinds of good research studies that tell us just how much family support matters in terms of protecting children. So that's really the question. How do we reach out to families? Once the kids are out there, of course, we need to be doing everything we can to protect them, to make sure they've got food and shelter. The very basics are often a real issue. Many of them are struggling with suicidality, and our services, all of our services around suicidality, need to be very, very ready for LGBT kids and adults. But, you know, to head it off, we want to be finding the ways to reach families. And that's certainly some of the work that when parents who've just begun to understand that their kids are gender independent, some of them are really very relaxed about it and it feels fine to them, and they're just concerned about things like protecting their child from bullying. But many really have to struggle. They may be part of a religious community that thinks it's not okay. They may have all kinds of their own internal homophobia or transphobia to deal with. So part of the task that I quite often get to do is just to create a safe place where they can talk about some of that and really face up to it in themselves and figure out a way to get past it. It's also really important that our schools, because that's where most kids are going to be going, that our schools are aware of and sensitive to these issues and ready again to just tell this kid, it's not just you, there's lots of people like you, you can have a perfectly good life. We can figure this out together.
Nicely said. Is there anything else that's important for us to discuss before we end this conversation,
Hershel? Oh, we could go on for hours.
We really could. We really, really could. I've just barely begun to talk all the questions I have.
I want to do a little bit of shameless advertising.
Please do.
On September the 25th, there's going to be a full day of training for primarily aimed at care providers and educators around working with gender-independent children and teens and their families. And we would love people to come. I can send you the link.
Yes, please do. And I will also, if it's okay with you, link to your website for anybody who is interested in meeting with you either one-on-one or going to some of your training or learning a bit more about these topics. Is that okay with you?
It's terrific. And even better, the Rainbow Health Ontario website and to Jordan Zaitzo at the Rainbow Health Ontario website. He is the guy who is more in touch with what's out there than anybody in the province. He's amazing.
Beautiful. I will do that. Herschel Russell, thank you very, very much for taking your time and explaining and sharing your own experiences and the experiences of those you work with. And I appreciate all the work that you do in here in Toronto and outside of the city.
Thanks, Wolfgang. Nice to talk to you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.